given its difficulties gaining control over the issue. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Daily Mirror has covered this story and tells us more. Research revealed on Thursday, 3rd of August, that 6 million workers are grappling with the cost of living crisis while toiling in insecure jobs. Analysts said grafters on zero-hours contracts, the low-paid self-employed, employees getting less than 16 hours a week, and people in casual, seasonal or fixed-term and agency roles were worse placed as they battled through the hardship. A survey study for the Living Wage Foundation found that 19% of British workers are in insecure jobs, while 10% are in insecure jobs that also pay below the real living wage. The figures represent 6.1 million and 3.4 million people respectively. Survation is a polling and market research agency based in London. Some 59% of all shift workers have received less than a week's notice of working hours, with 13% being given less than 24 hours' notice. Critics say it makes life difficult for people to arrange other employment and plan paying bills, and with some even driven to food banks. A quarter of shift workers have had stints cancelled unexpectedly by their boss, with 90% not given their full rate of pay and 22% plunging deeper into debt or turning to credit cards. The foundation said workers who are most affected by insecurity are those least well-placed to manage its financial burdens. It highlighted cleaners, delivery drivers and some National Health Service staff as being up to five times more likely to be in insecure jobs than those earning at or above the real living wage. The minimum hourly legal rate for staff aged over 23 years old is £10.42 an hour, while the voluntary real living wage is £10.90 an hour for workers of all ages, rising to £11.95 an hour in London. The Living Wage Foundation urged British firms to sign up to its latest scheme, Living Hours. Under the project, employers pledge to provide at least 4 weeks' notice for every shift, with guaranteed payment if shifts are cancelled within that notice period. Companies also offer a guaranteed minimum of 16 working hours a week, unless the worker requests fewer and a contract reflecting hours worked. The foundation's director, Catherine Chapman, said soaring prices have rightly shone a spotlight on pay this past year, but this research makes clear that reliable working hours are as vital as workers' financial resilience as a real living wage. It is shocking that 3.4 million workers are facing the cost of living crisis in low-paying jobs with unstable working hours, making planning a life and a budget impossible. Catherine Chapman added, while the rate of inflation has begun to fall, households across the country don't need economists to tell them that prices remain exorbitantly high. That is why we're calling on employers to join those who have already stepped up during this crisis and commit to provide workers with living hours, secure guaranteed hours and notice of shift patterns alongside a real living wage. Joseph Rowntree's Foundation's senior policy advisor, Louise Woodruff, said, reliable hours and a real living wage are the foundations of good employment, making it truly shocking that this report reveals millions of people are navigating the cost of living crisis in low-paid, insecure jobs. It's clear we cannot beat in-work poverty without profound changes in Britain's labour market. The Living Wage Foundation's Living Hours scheme provides employers with a framework to lead us towards a future of stable employment and decent pay. Of Dignity for Servation polled 2,023 people online in April. The website Reddit has also covered the same story and tells us more. Against the backdrop of coronavirus pandemic and soaring inflation, British businesses have defied the odds and signed up to join the living wage movement in record numbers over the past 2 years. There are now 13,000 living wage employers across the United Kingdom signed up to pay the independently calculated real living wage to all directly employed and subcontracted staff. Insecure work, especially when coupled with low pay, remains a vicious combination trapping millions of people in in-work poverty. New research from the Living Wage Foundation released on Thursday, 3rd of August, reveals that a staggering 6 million British jobs are insecure, including over a million people on zero-hour contracts. As well as making it hard to budget and plan, insecure employment costs workers. This insecurity premium can add up to £600 per year because of last-minute shift cancellations or being called into work at short notice. For example, 27% of insecure workers had to spend more on travel, 17% have had to pay higher childcare costs, and around 24% have had shifts cancelled unexpectedly, with 25% then not paid at all. With pay packets already eroded by high inflation, these additional costs place yet another pressure on those at the sharpest end of the cost of living crisis. Economists say job security is a critical next piece of the picture if British officials are to eradicate in-work poverty in the United Kingdom. The website of iNews has also covered the same story and tells us more. Polling showed the majority of British people say they are struggling or just about managing in the face of the worst cost of living crisis in a generation. An exclusive survey by BMG Consulting on behalf of iNews reveals that nearly 6 in 10 voters, or 58%, say they are just staying afloat due to the historic squeeze on household budgets. The figures come just days before the Bank of England will decide on whether to raise interest rates for the 14th consecutive time, with speculation mounting that the bank could increase interest rates by a quarter of a percentage point to 5.25%. Pressure is on the bank to raise interest rates for both the US Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank, the ECB, increased base rates by a quarter of a percentage point recently. It comes amid growing fears that another rate rise risks tipping the economy into an unnecessary recession, with households already battling to keep their finances in check. Polling for iNews shows that Britons are far more likely to say they're struggling or just about managing in the current climate. Perhaps of greater concern for the government, more than half, or 52%, of the more than 1,500 people surveyed say they were worried about paying for everyday essentials such as food, petrol and bills each month. Of that, nearly 1 in 5, or 18%, said they were very worried. An overwhelming majority of respondents, 80%, said the cost of living crisis was the biggest issue facing the country at the moment, placing a further question mark over Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's chances at the next election, given his difficulties gaining control over the issue. Inflation has remained stubbornly high throughout 2023, with the latest figures showing prices rising by 7.9%. The slowing in inflation has left the Prime Minister facing an uphill battle to bring it down to half the 10.1% he committed to in January. But the headline inflation rate only shows part of the picture, with the cost of food in the United Kingdom higher than it has been for more than 40 years.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the value of the contemplation of the Holy Quran in our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is such an honor to be here at your service. In today's episode, we are talking about the importance of the contemplation upon the Holy Quran in our Islamic lifestyle. So, dear friends, of course, as we know, the Holy Quran is this divine book which was revealed by the Almighty Allah. This in itself is something which should really increase the value and the importance of this beautiful book, this holy book, this divine book, the Holy Quran. And of course, we see that in the day and age that we live, where certain barbaric individuals under certain barbaric governments are allowed to burn the Holy Quran. This is one of the greatest tragedies of the modern era. And truly, this burning of the Holy Quran is the burning of the word of the Almighty Allah. And how can it be acceptable in any society to burn the religious values and to burn the religious sanctities of another religion? And so this burning of the Holy Quran is a truly savage and barbaric act by uncivilized individuals who live in uncivilized societies. And as Muslims who have pride in our divine book, we must stand up and voice our opposition to this blatant, barbaric act committed by savages. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we were talking about the importance of a contemplation upon the Holy Quran. We had gotten a little bit sidetracked, but it was an important thing to note, which is that we must stand up in defense of the Holy Quran. This is the defense of Islam. This is the defense of a divine book, which has been revealed by the Almighty Allah. Now, when we're talking about the contemplation upon the Holy Quran, yes, we find that the first step to being close with the Holy Quran is to recite the Arabic. Of course, even before we start to recite the Arabic, what is important is for us to understand the value of the Holy Quran, the importance of the Holy Quran, and really this great auspicious status of the Holy Quran. And not only should we know this, but we should let our friends and the people who we love and the people around us know this value and the status of the Holy Quran. Now, contemplating upon the Holy Quran is of great importance. So once we realize the value of the Quran, and then we start to recite the Holy Quran, then of course the next step is contemplation. Now, we probably won't be able to fully talk about this idea of contemplating over the Holy Quran, but we will elaborate more in other programs, inshallah. But at least take some time to contemplate over the words of the Holy Quran so that the meaning of the Holy Quran can really permeate through our being and our essence, and inshallah, it will be an integral part of our Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part, we saw that more than 50 countries have depleted uranium weapons. These weapons have been used extensively by U.S. and NATO forces during the past three decades, namely in Iraq and the Balkans. The consequences for both military personnel and civilians have proven to be tragic. Yet despite the evidence, the military industry and nuclear authorities continue to downplay the dangers. Don't go away. Here's the rest of the program.
Our soldiers on peace missions in the Balkans are said to have been contaminated due to the presence of depleted uranium in the munitions.
My friends, we have with us Sergeant Major Antonacci. Unfortunately, you're ill. Could you tell us how this came about?
I left on August the 31st, 1998, for a six-month mission. I got the go-ahead after medical checks. During my stay in Sarajevo, I suffered several faint and dizzy spells. And a few months after I came back, these were attributed to lymphoma.
Cancer?
In Florence, I meet General Fabio Mini. In 2002, he takes command of the NATO mission in Kosovo. He's immediately concerned by the risks involved with depleted uranium, following NATO strikes in the area in 1999.
My chain of command, formed by an American admiral in Naples and the Supreme Allied Commander in Brussels, stood by the official directives and reports, including those drawn up by scientists in the U.S. I was therefore frequently confronted with this type of response. It's true, Fabio. You're right to be worried, but we have reports which say that there's no problem. And from a military point of view, we can't bypass them to do things that go beyond what is asked of us, and which could even prevent us from accomplishing our mission. So it was recommended that we reiterate and support among the civil population the fact that it wasn't a grave danger, that it was quite normal. And to say to the military, especially the engineer corps, treat the depleted uranium munitions like any other type of munitions. But a grenade is not the same thing as a depleted uranium projectile. I'll tell you something. In 2007, I was treated for a tumor in my colon. I never wondered if it was because of the year I spent in Kosovo. But I'll always have doubts. I still have a doubt today that it was perhaps due to that.
Politicians in Rome are mobilized, as is the government. For the first time, without waiting for definitive scientific confirmation, a law recognizes the danger of depleted uranium. When Arturo Parisi is appointed Minister of Defense in 2006, the case is one of his first preoccupations.
Our concern is that the suffering, the pain, the injuries, deaths, and damage should never go beyond by even a millimeter what has been foreseen in some way. The problem with depleted uranium, and this was what worried us, is that not only does it produce negative effects, as in the military sector almost everything produces negative effects, but also that it produces uncontrollable effects, which go beyond the present. That's the problem with depleted uranium. So from this point of view, something that might appear not too costly could, on the contrary, with time, become very costly.
Here we have a depleted uranium shell. Its radioactivity level is 40% less than what we can find here in this room.
The Atlantic Alliance is slow to acknowledge the use of depleted uranium weapons in the Balkans. In 2001, an official report estimates the quantities used at more than 3 tons in Bosnia and 10 tons in Kosovo. But NATO command refuses to confirm any link whatsoever between its airstrikes and any contamination. When I contacted the Allied Forces Communications Agency in Brussels, nobody was willing to answer my questions. In France, Alain Acariès is an inconsolable father. His son died in 1997 from lymph gland cancer. Ludovic was a soldier driving a truck in Bosnia. A truck that was contaminated, claims Alain Acariès, by depleted uranium dust since the Gulf War. He had his suspicions confirmed by an independent laboratory.
Mr. Acariès provided them with several samples of his son's cancerous lymph glands taken in a French hospital after his death. A powerful electronic microscope and a new technique perfected by Professor Gatti revealed the interior of the tissue.
We can clearly see the tiny particles, nanoparticles. They're not degradable nor compatible. They're not compatible with life.
Even more surprising is the chemical composition of these nanoparticles.
There is silver, chlorine, gold, magnesium, and silicon, which form a very strange material that doesn't exist in nature.
You've been working on this case for 11 years, and you've taken legal action. What's the situation today?
Despite what was revealed by the examination, the link with depleted uranium has been denied.
But why are you doing all this?
I want the truth to be acknowledged. I want people to accept that my son was contaminated through the fault of the army, which didn't decontaminate the trucks in the Gulf. Something has to be done. We can't just let it slide. It's been the biggest tragedy in my life.
An association, Avigolf, of which Alain Acariès is a member, has been formed to inform potential depleted uranium victims, most of whom are soldiers, and to support them in their legal battles for justice. I met the magistrate in charge of the affairs filed with the county court in Paris. But the judge, Bertala Geoffroy, is naturally subject to rules of confidentiality. Despite the slow legal progress, Alain Acariès is still hopeful of winning the case he has lodged. Against him, the military institution remains rooted in its own convictions.
We're not unfamiliar with the debate, and we're taking it into account. But quite simply, we can observe that until now, no study, and God knows many studies have been carried out through the United Nations Environmental Programme, the World Health Organization, or by the International Atomic Energy Agency, and no study has highlighted or demonstrated any long-term harmful consequences on health or on the environment.
Are there any operational theatres where France has intervened recently where these depleted uranium weapons have been used?
No, these weapons haven't been used by France in any operational theatres. I would remind you that depleted uranium munitions are conventional weapons and recognized as such by every international convention. They're not nuclear weapons, which the word uranium could suggest.
France's position is in contradiction with efforts undertaken by the European Parliament. For years, European deputies have been calling for a moratorium on the manufacture and use of these weapons, with MEPs voting such resolutions almost unanimously. Monica Frassoni is co-president of the European Green Party.
The ongoing story began with strange events during the Gulf War, then continued and intensified with the war in Yugoslavia, and it became an almost traditional theme for the European Parliament. One important element, in my view, is that France and the UK have always refused to enforce bans and to support the moratorium on depleted uranium. Very often, we can see the extreme reticence of governments and armies, even of political forces, to raise the subject in public.
The urgent need for more concerted political action against depleted uranium is only more apparent when a new war breaks out, exposing new risks. My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq. In 2003, the United States attack Iraq to oust Saddam Hussein, who continues to taunt the US despite 12 years of rigorous sanctions. At the time, I'm in Baghdad, witnessing the repeated air attacks targeting the presidential palaces with depleted uranium projectiles. It's a short-lived war. In just 3 weeks, the Americans removed the dictator. Jim McDermott is not a typical American congressman. He's one of the few who have seen war close up. As an officer, he served in Vietnam, and as a psychiatrist, he has treated some of those who survived.
Mm-hmm. This, when I was dealing,
Bush lied, because I went over to Iraq and what became Baghdad Jim, not by intention, but because I was there, and they asked me what I thought, and I said, I think he's going to mislead us to get us into war. And so then we did it to all the rest of the country. I mean, and Fallujah was the Basra of 91. Fallujah was where we used absolutely awesome power to destroy that city.
In 2004, the Americans are confronted with massive insurrection. The epicenter is Fallujah. To stem the revolt, the city is bombarded. A deluge of fire rains down with white phosphorus and depleted uranium munitions. Today, peace has been restored to the city of mosques, and life has returned under the watchful eye of the Iraqi army. At the new hospital, Dr. Samira Alan shows me the tragedy she has to face every day.
They born prematurely and before they complete their pregnancy, just less than 8 months. And one of them born with cleft lip and palate.
These babies will have surgery, right?
Of course, if he survives. If he survives, yes.
Yeah.
Since 2006, we start to notice that there is an abnormal increase in the incidence of congenital anomalies among the birth in our hospital. According to the cases we register, the incidence about 14.7 per 1,000 live birth.
What would be a normal rate of deficiency?
It should not exceed 1 or 2 per 1,000. We examined 25 families from Fallujah. Those families have babies born with birth defects. We took hair sample from the kids and from the parents, and we sent these samples to an independent lab in Germany, and we found high concentration of uranium, mercury, bismuth, and other trace elements that is not usually used by human being and not naturally present in the soil or in the plants.
In Baghdad, the authorities have to take their religious leaders' opinions into account. Their voices carry weight, and their criticism is widely heard. Jawad al-Halisi is the heir to a very influential dynasty, and he protests strongly against what he sees as an attack on his people's genetic integrity.
These deformed children are the result of the use of depleted uranium. They're deformed fetuses. An international effort is required to clean up. In the same way, they brought together 30 countries and their armies under the pretext of getting rid of Saddam Hussein. They should work together on a cleansing project, like with the Marshall Plan in Germany, because the sanitary situation in Iraq is catastrophic.
Unlike after the Gulf War of 1991, the U.S. Defense Department has never published figures concerning the use of depleted uranium during the war in Iraq in 2003. Unofficial estimates speak of over 2,000 tons. Since the beginning of my investigation, I've been trying to obtain a reaction from the Pentagon. After weeks of exchanging emails, a spokesman finally responds. Dear sir, we won't be able to accommodate your on-camera interview request. The scientific community have investigated the radiological safety and environmental impacts of depleted uranium for several decades. The Agency for Disease Control and Prevention has stated that it is aware of no cancers or cases of leukemia among workers or other populations that can be attributed to exposure to natural or depleted uranium. In Washington, Time magazine called Thomas Pickering the five-star general of the diplomatic corps. He was actively involved in the international mobilization against Saddam Hussein in 2001. But he openly opposed the war in 2003.
Iraqis who say, look, we came in and created a mess and we didn't resolve it all, in my view, have some justification for their position. I leave it to wise men, lawyers, and judges to tell you whether the answer to the Iraqi is we still owe them more. But if I were an Iraqi, I suppose they would say, yeah, you've got to create a perfect paradise here.
I can understand from an armament standpoint and from a strategic planning standpoint, why you'd want to have the hardest and the best weapons that could just demolish anything. They're unwilling to look at the aftermath of it and what the Geneva Convention and other things say about, you know, what you leave on the ground afterward. The military is not very well known for its ability to clean up after itself.
The official reluctance to consider the sanitary and environmental impact of depleted uranium can also be explained by economic reasons.
Obviously, from the Army's point of view, and technically, if I have to make a hole in a tank, depleted uranium is great because it's really effective and it's recyclable too. I think in that situation there's little to be said.
It's a win-win situation.
Yes, but just one detail. In Serbia, they saw that to clean one 30-millimeter head from shells that were fired, just to clean where they landed, they spent $300,000, more or less. It might be a win-win situation, but if I have to clean up afterwards...
It's a very expensive win-win situation.
Exactly, for the authorities. And those are figures that have been acknowledged and quoted.
The cost of cleaning up a zone contaminated by depleted uranium dust makes it hard to envisage that the battlefields will one day be rehabilitated. And there's worse. The depleted uranium producing countries like the US and France have to deal with the accumulation of increasingly vast stocks. More than 700,000 tons in the US, almost 200,000 tons in France. Robert Alvarez, a former advisor to the US Energy Department, has been sounding the alarm bells for a number of years.
What we are dealing with, in a certain respect, is what I call national sacrifice zones, that we, in order to amass nuclear weapons in this country, we created very large, profound areas of contamination where we simply lack the capability and the technology to restore them to their original conditions, much less to conditions that would allow even limited uses. So these are areas that we more or less have to sacrifice in the name of nuclear deterrence.
It is by chance that I make an astonishing discovery in Iraq, which confirms Robert Alvarez's alarmist prediction. Close to Basra Airport, the broken shells of tanks destroyed in 2003 are lined up along the road. Soldiers tell me of incidents previously kept secret.
The tanks were contaminated by uranium. A team from the Environment Ministry examined them, and they confirmed the contamination. From time to time, the Americans and the British come here, and they take tanks away somewhere, transporting them further away from the airport. But we don't know what becomes of them.
But I want to know. For the contaminated scrap metal, this mysterious destination is the end of the road, and finding it would mean the end of my investigation. I decide to speak to General Jabbar, who commands the border police in the Basra region.
Some of the scrap was moved to this desert place. How do you call it?
It's called Afr el Batin.
When was it moved there?
The program was set up in 2008. To this provisional site, they've transported 150 tons of scrap metal.
What happened to the scrap? When it gets there, when they bring it there, then they put it in the ground, what do they do with the scrap?
They dig and they put it in holes in the ground. They simply take it from one place to another. Obviously, it's in the desert. But according to our information, there are water tables below. Scientific reports say it's potentially dangerous for the water.
I do my utmost to get to Afr el Batin. I need an authorization and an escort. General Jabbar promises to help. But then a counter order arrives from Baghdad. The affair is beyond his authority, and only a minister can give me the required permission. I know Iraq too well. It will never happen.
One of the things you learn as a child is clean up your own mess. Don't expect somebody else to come in here and pick up your crayons and your toys. So we did this war of choice, and my view is that we have a responsibility for the mess we leave. We can't walk away and just say, well, we don't care.
The depleted uranium question, like any question involving armies, weapons and wars, suffers from a lack of transparency, from a lack of precise democratic control on both national and European levels. I think the priority is to continue the fight on the UN level, which is very useful, and also within the European Union, so that we can obtain a moratorium on depleted uranium munitions.
Countries that have used depleted uranium weapons, quite obviously, are not interested in being raked over the coals for a weapon system they feel they have a right to use and which they feel is not dangerous. But we will see. The international community doesn't stand still on these kinds of things. And I think that if there's an increasing effort to say, look, here are the damages, and you have to have something concrete, and you have to say that this is more than a supposition, and that we have done some research, and unfortunately you have to bring examples of where beyond the pure use of depleted uranium as a tank buster, you have created a special kind of damage to the individuals beyond what normally conventional weapons create, then I think you have a basis for moving ahead.
Depleted uranium munitions were invented in the 1970s to combat Moscow's armored divisions. The Soviet enemy has disappeared, but this all-powerful arsenal has remained. Those responsible for authorizing its use will one day have to be accountable to the victims and explain why they turned a deaf ear to every appeal for caution.
The most brave people are the people who've never been to war. The ones who think war is such a great deal and want to go to the parades and stand there and see the flags go by near the bands. They haven't been anywhere near what it's like when they come.
And that's it for this week's episode. And don't forget to share your thoughts and comments with us. Until next week and another Aperture. Goodbye.
اقرأ باسم ربك الذي خلق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها المزمل. قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا
قد عودتك ربي بقرآن جنبني حراني.
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفران يا من ينجينا إحسان ودعوتك ربي بقرآن.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم.
السلام عليكم. Respected brothers and sisters, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, welcome to Let's Recite the Quran Kareem, a series of Quranic sessions held by IRIB English Radio in cooperation with Sevier International Schools Network. Here we are again, alhamdulillah, with brothers Ali Nasir, Sayyid Ali Nasir, Hassan Asrullah, Hussein Ruhullah, and Fawad Haider. Assalamu alaikum, brothers. Welcome to Let's Recite the Quran Kareem. How are you?
Fine, sir.
Fine, inshallah, Fawad.
Fine, sir.
Alhamdulillah. Ali Nasir?
Alhamdulillah, sir.
Okay, Hussein Ruhullah?
Alhamdulillah.
Alhamdulillah. Sir. Everyone is fine. Dear listeners, we hope, inshallah, you are fine as well. So, inshallah, today we will work on Ayah 80 of Surah Ali Imran on page 60. Right, Fawad?
Yes.
Inshallah. Our brothers and sisters, thank you so much for being with us. I really want you to, inshallah, stay till the end of this session. And now, if you have your Quran with you, turn to page 60, Ayah 80 of Surah Ali Imran. Everyone, Let's listen to the recitation once.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa la ya'murukum an tattakhidul malaa'ikata wan nabiyyina arbaba. Aya'murukum bil kufri ba'da id antum muslimun.
Nice recitation. May Allah bless him, inshallah. That was a great recitation, right?
Yes.
So, inshallah, we will be able to recite as well at the end of this session, okay? This ayah. We'll work on the tajweed rules, inshallah, and we'll read the Quran, recite the Quran with tajweed rules. Brothers and sisters, stay with us, inshallah, till the end of this session, okay? I will read this ayah once, and a short explanation will be given, inshallah. Then we'll move on to the tajweed rules, the same as our previous sessions. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم ولا يأمركم أن تتخذوا الملائكة والنبيين أربابا أيأمركم بالكفر بعد إذ أنتم مسلمون. So in this ayah Allah Almighty continues the explanation to the previous ayah. So in the previous ayah, as we said, Allah Almighty in the Quran says, مَا كَانَ لِبَشَرٍ أَن يُؤْتِيَهُ اللَّهُ الْكِتَابَ وَالْحُكْمَ وَالنُّبُوَّةِ ثُمَّ يَقُولَ لِلنَّاسِ كُنُوا عِبَادًا لِي. We said that Allah Almighty says that it is not the right to a person, okay? He doesn't have a right, okay? To when we give him the hukm, the nubuwa, the judgment, the prophethood, okay, when we give him this, and he then preaches for himself, and then he invites people towards himself, he doesn't have the right, okay? Any prophet doesn't have this right. And that's why we see all the prophets from Adam alayhi salam till Khatam alayhi salatullah alayhi, every single of them had been preaching one religion of God. And they were inviting people towards God. Yes? So, thousands of years have been passed, they have been doing the same, right? And they were also letting the people know about the next prophet who comes. So it shows their truthfulness, yes? They were trustworthy. So, in this ayah, Allah Almighty says that they were not also inviting, okay? وَلَا يَأْمُرَكُمْ and he would not command you to take the angels themselves as well, they do not do it, okay? To worship them, they do not invite towards themselves. And also they do not command the people. He doesn't have the right to command the people to take malaika, the angels and the prophets for lords. Okay? They do not do it. Like Prophet Isa alayhi salam in the Quran we have, okay? Allah Almighty says, أَأَنْتَ قُلْتَ لِلنَّاسِ اتَّخِذُونِي وَأُمِّيَ إِلَهَيْنِ Allah Almighty asks, Prophet Isa alayhi salam, okay, that in the day of judgment, that أَأَنْتَ قُلْتَ لِلنَّاسِ you said to the people that اتَّخِذُونِي وَأُمِّي إِلَهَيْنِ, okay, take me and my mom, okay, my mother, okay, as your Lord. Accept me and my mom as your Lord. Worship me and my mom. Prophet Isa alayhi salam said, قَالُوا سُبْحَانَكَ I didn't say it. تَعْلَمُ مَا فِي نَفْسِي you know me. You know what is in my heart, okay? Allah Almighty just wants to show us, okay, that even if Allah Almighty asks Prophet Isa, of course it's not that way, okay? That Prophet Isa never told the people, okay, to worship him. That Christians, okay, they worship him. They call him God. This is a false belief, right?
Yes.
So, وَلَا يَأْمُرَكُمْ أَن تَتَّخِذُوا الْمَلَائِكَةِ وَالنَّبِيِّينَ أَرْبَابًا أَيَأْمُرُكُمْ بِالْكُفْرِ would he call you to be unfaith, to disbelieve after you have been Muslims? You are Muslims. So if any person comes and invites you towards like kufr, atheism, okay, will you accept it? No, never. Never. This is the right path, okay? That one should be an idiot, okay, who goes astray. If he finds this way the right way, okay, if he just turns back, okay? He should be an idiot. May Allah Almighty help us stay firm on this path, inshallah. Okay?
Inshallah.
So guys, so this, the message of this ayah was this, that any invitation, any invitation, okay, from anyone who is inviting you towards something rather than Allah. Okay? That is for sure shirk. Okay? Shirk doesn't mean this, okay, that only we should not believe that there is another God, okay? If someone comes to you and invites you towards worshipping, for example, the moon, worshipping the cows, God forbid, like the, some of the Hindus they do, right? Like worshipping any prophet, any angel. So these all are shirk. Got it? So we don't have to really give them a single value. يبكي يسأل خالقه فأتاه الوحي فأشرق اقرأ اقرأ.
Let's recite the Quran.
اقرأ باسم ربك الذي خلق.
So that's it, okay? And inshallah I want you to refer to the Tafasir books if you want to learn more. So inshallah, do it so. I should mention the important tajweed rules now, and Hassan Hussein and Ali Nasir, you will inshallah, Fawad, you will practice with me. Yes?
Yep.
Yes. Okay. So, وَلَا يَأْمُرَكُمْ أَن تَتَّخِذُوا الْمَلَائِكَةَ وَالنَّبِيِّينَ أَرْبَابًا أَيَأْمُرُكُمْ بِالْكُفْرِ بَعْدَ إِذْ أَنْتُمْ مُسْلِمُونَ. What do you think the first thing to mention?
The pronunciation. Good job, of the good job.
So mention them, please. For what?
First one, wow.
Wow has to be pronounced like wa sound, right? Not va. Good job. Next.
Ka.
Ka. Ka.
F.
What do you mean? Ka. Oh, you mean Hamza. Oh, God. Kaf. Kaf is easy, yeah. K, the letter K in English, it's easy. Letter. I mean, the letters which are a bit difficult. And we might miss up, okay, mix up. What?
Kha.
Kha, yes. Kha. Antatakhidhu. Good job. Here, kha has a light sound. Khi. Good job. Hamza, a sound. With a ra sound, they are a bit different. Next one.
Ha.
Ra.
Ra, good one. Aro. Arubab. Ya'mura. Arubaban. Good job. And?
Ayn.
Ayn. Where is the ayn?
Ba'd.
Oh, بعد إذا. Good job. بعد عين. Next letter.
ذال.
ذال إذ. إذ أنتم. So these are the letters which are important, yes? The rest of them are easy, and we have the counterparts in English as well, yes? We have the similar sound in English. So they are easy. ولا يأمركم. The next rule. There is no special rule in the two first words. ولا يأمركم. Except... What they? Ra, heavy sound, yeah? The tafkhim or ra. Rakum. Do not say it. Rakum. Rakum. Antatakhidhu.
Ikhfa.
Aha, noon sakin. After the noon sakin, if you have the letter ta, fa, dal, jim, ha,
sin,
sheen, fa, qaf, kaf, ha? Za, val. So what do? You hide the sound of that noon or tanwin. Okay? Like, how to correctly do it? Look, when you say noon, an, everyone say, an. You see, like, your tongue touches the back part of your teeth. Yes? Uh-huh. Here. Right? The top part. The gum area. An. But when you do the ikhfa, your tongue goes there, okay? And it is about to touch it. Don't let it touch. That's it. That's it, okay? Do not let your tongue touch that area. If it touches, it pronounces the noon, okay? It produces the sound noon. But do not do it, okay? That's called ikhfa. Hide the sound. Try it, Hassan. That's correct. That's correct. تتخذوا. تتخذوا الملائكة. تتخذوا ends with a waw mad, oo sound. And الملائكة has a Hamza tul wasl. Right?
Yes.
Al. And then you have to hear what? Skip that Hamza tul wasl plus skip
the mad.
The mad, right?
Yes.
The waw mad here. So, أن تتخذوا الملائكة, not تتخذوا الملائكة. No wow, okay? Do not stretch it. تتخذوا الملائكة. Fast and quick. So, ملائكة, we have said this word a lot, okay? The mad is? The mad is wajib, yes? The word ملائكة, الملائكة, we've said it many times, okay? The mad here is?
Wajib.
A wajib mad. You should stretch because the hamza and alif mad are in the same word. الملائكة والنبيين والنبيين ألف همزة الوصل and لام التعريف will be skipped because نون is
a send letter
okay when you skip همزة الوصل you should skip the لام as well والنبيين نون مشتت produce a nasal sound نبيين there is a ya make sure you stretch it نبيين أربابا تفخيم الراء good job فوات أرباباً but when you stop here تنوين فتحة changes to
ألف
مد أربابا and when you stop here make sure you stretch a bit the sound okay أربابا
for two counts
yeah for two counts three no two counts is the natural one but you can stretch it for four counts for three counts okay since مد العرض للسكون can be applied as well so قلا is a sign to stop and it tells us it's better to
Stop,
but you still can continue. And the next word, rule, أَيَأْمُرُكُمْ مِمْ سَاكِنْ plus ba. So, إِخْفَى, right? أَيَأْمُرُكُمْ بِالْكُفْرِ بَعْدَ إِذْ أَنْتُمْ أَنْتُمْ Hide the sound, like we said. أَنْتُمْ مِمْ إِذْغَمْ مِثْلَيْنْ مُسْلِمُونَ That's all, إِذْغَمْ مِثْلَيْنْ for two counts. I will read it once, okay? Listen carefully and repeat. Now that we know all the tajweed rules here. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
ولا يأمركم أن تتخذوا الملائكة والنبيين أربابا
ولا يأمركم أن تتخذوا الملائكة والنبيين أربابا
أَيَأْمُرُكُمْ بِالْكُفْرِ بَعْدَ إِذْ أَنْتُمْ مُسْلِمُونَ
أَيَأْمُرُكُمْ بِالْكُفْرِ بَعْدَ إِذْ أَنْتُمْ مُسْلِمُونَ
صدق الله العلي العظيم
صدق الله العلي العظيم
أحسنت ما شاء الله الله bless you إن شاء الله brothers and sisters dear listeners of IRB English Radio thank you so much for being with us that's all from us for today we practiced this ayah with tajweed rules we explained it a bit إن شاء الله we wish you have learned something thank you so much for being with us إن شاء الله we recommend you to stay with IRB English Radio in coming sessions we'll be here إن شاء الله the same time tomorrow Inshallah, another Quranic session will be dedicated to you, inshallah. If no questions, brothers, let's finish the session. No questions?
No.
Thanks to IRB English Radio. Thanks to Sevier International Schools for cooperations. Wa sallallahu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa alihi al-tahirin.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. وعجل فرجهم
Let's recite the Quran. A joint production of IRIB English Radio and Xavier International Schools.
ذكر وموعظة ونور فيه شفاء للصدور وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته
نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبي لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان والقرآن.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up...